Are you shocked by what you read in the newspaper or what you hear on the radio or perhaps what you see on television? It's hard to sort out what's true or false. We're faced with an information overload. It's like going to a buffet where much of the food is false, but you can't tell just by looking. Many Japanese restaurants have a display window in the front of the restaurant. And so it was quite an experience when I was walking by on the sidewalk. You can look at the display window and you can take a look through the window and you see all these delicious servings or dishes of food. And the food looks real, but it's only made of plastic, very colorful. And they do a very good job of making this fake food look realistic and delicious. Well, today I want to cover the subject of living in the post-truth world, living in a post-truth world. We're bombarded with many modern-day examples of what has come to be known as fake news. And we have the advantage of reading about some of the biblical examples of fake news. The Bible offers us some pointers on how to conduct ourselves in this world where truth is not easy to find. About the time of the Spanish-American War in 1898 between the United States and Spain, war arose over an incident in Cuba. And I was looking at this recently, and a famous newspaper publisher named William Randolph Hearst published a magazine, or a newspaper rather, called the New York Journal. And it was very colorful, it was influential, it was outspoken. And he sent to Cuba someone to get pictures of the build-up and of the war that was going on between America and Spain, because Spain owned Cuba at the time. And so when he sent his man down to Cuba, the fellow responded that there really wasn't any war going on there. There wasn't anything there. And he sent a cable back to New York. And Hearst then replied by cable, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war." Well, in 1898, of course, we had the bombing of a U.S. ship, and some suspicion as to who really initiated the bombing and that initiating a war, all what it may be, very well, on false pretenses. And so it's still unclear as to whether or not the newspaper created the war. But it is understandable that the events of 1898 and 1899 might have been very different if William Randolph Hearst would have reported news differently. In fact, they call this yellow journalism, is this kind of sensational type of journalism. But this isn't the only instance that we find where there's what is now recently become known as fake news. I have a list here where somebody has compiled the 7 worst examples of fake news. A fellow by the name of John Hawkins wrote this in townhall.com. And he made a list, and he said, these are very famous, now noted issues, and we've all lived through these together. And he goes through a list. And then there was Newsweek magazine, for example, that had a big story about how in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where there was an American camp that was a prison for international terrorists, and Newsweek came up with a story that Americans were flushing the Koran down the toilet. And of course, this caused a lot of international outrage that Americans would do this outrageously to a religion, to disdain a particular religion. And yet, after time, the editor admits that Mark Whitaker, last May 23rd, says the sourcing was suspect. He admits the sourcing was suspect and stated, "We regret that we got any part of our story wrong and extend sympathy to the victims of the violence and the U.S. soldiers caught in its midst." Well, I guess they didn't properly secure the information to begin with. And then there's another story, which somebody has labeled Rathergate, And CBS News published this when Dan Rather was with them, an anchorman. And as it was reported, here was an anchorman who had a grudge against the George W. Bush, who was soon to be president. And someone gave to him copies of documents that no one has been able to prove actually existed. And so somebody examined the documents, for which Dan Rather was lambasting the future president, and they were supposedly written on a typewriter in the 1970s. And yet, when you take a look at the documents, you can see that they were the same font as a Microsoft Word, which did not exist in the 1970s. So it was easy to track that, in fact, the documents were fake, and yet didn't really look behind the scene to find out something that any seventh grader could have determined rather quickly. There's another example about NBC and CNN. If we remember the George Zimmerman case in Texas, in Florida, where unfortunately a young black man, Trayvon Martin, was killed in this interchange. And so the transcript that NBC played, they said that Mr. Zimmerman, who shot the other fellow, they quoted him as saying, "This guy looks like he's up to no good. He looks black." Well, that was what they quoted. They took the tape and they produced a tape like that. In reality, what the fellow did, what the actual transcript said, is, "This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about." The police dispatcher said, "Okay, this guy, is he black, white, or Hispanic?" And Zimmerman responds, "He looks black." So what they did is they simply cut all of the middle part out, took the beginning, cut out the middle, put in the end, and made it look as if that he was attempting to slam the person simply because of race. And if you take a look, this was what NBC, CNN did something similar, and using and interpreted his words to mean words that I cannot repeat in polite company, whether in school or church. And they simply took a slurred word because of the cold weather, and then chose to interpret it in the worst possible way. When you slow down the tape, it was actually just, "I'm cold," something to that nature. And then you have the case that some of you may have heard about some years ago, when NBC showed an expose on a General Motors pickup truck and how it would explode upon impact. And this was 14 minutes. And they had 17 seconds of crash footage. And as there was this crash, then it shows how the gas tanks would catch fire in sideways collisions. Well, what General Motors did is they went to 22 junkyards. They bought as many vehicles of those kind as they could and fixed them up and tried to recreate that scenario from every angle and every opportunity, and found then enough evidence to debunk the entire report from NBC. And so while NBC at that time said the truck's gas tank had ruptured, an X-ray then later showed it hadn't really ruptured, and that the consultants had set off miniature rockets beneath the truck before the crash in order to give the visual effect, yet they never bothered to tell the viewers. So there's a lot of things that go on with that one. That was the fourth one. And then there's the fifth one, really a damning one, in the New York Times. They call it the Jason Blair scandal, where a young man who was an intern at the newspaper began writing stories and just making them up and putting them in as if they had real and actual sources. And it took a while because the Times, because they wanted to be racially respectful, never bothered to dig behind the story and see if they were correct. And so they gave it all kinds of account accuracy and credibility, claiming that, he was a young man just out of college. Well, as it turned out, he wasn't even out of college yet at the time. They were just tales spun upon top of other tales. And then the Rolling Stone magazine put forth a story that said that there was a sports team that had implicated in sexual assault on the campus of the University of Virginia. And they said, now it will have to pay. Except that it was false. And a jury later came to find that the magazine had committed defamation against the University of Virginia associate dean, who had been portrayed negatively in the article called A Rape on Campus. And so the owner of the magazine, as well as the author of the story, was found liable because they were not telling the truth and people were damaged or hurt by it. And the seventh story on the top seven list is the Hands Up, Don't Shoot that was promoted by a number of journalists that about the Ferguson, Missouri incident. And so when they have now the detailed information from the video and such, it finds out it never really occurred. It was used as a justification later for political objectives. So you have these examples of what is being foisted upon us in the world. The most recent one that has just occurred, that the top seven list was published before this most recent one came out. And I want to just examine this one a bit. And because we've had a political campaign this last year, there's lots of, how should we say, a lot of spaghetti flew against the walls on this one. And some of it stuck a little better than others. And so here's the story. Now, one of the most pronounced or biggest newspapers in the country, the Washington Post, put up a story about how the nation of Russia was hacked into the power grid of the United States. So the Washington Post published this about how this had all occurred, and yet there was an interesting the play on it, because it served a political purpose for which the Washington Post was attempting to portray, that the Americans were being used, or rather, that the Russians were burrowing into the United States, and that it fit onto a narrative that the Russians were the Russians did it. You know, everything was Russian that was going. Except that the problem was they didn't bother to call the utility, and the utility put out an hour and a half later after the story broke and said, "Wait a minute, you guys don't have it right here. One person at the public utility has a laptop computer at home that got a virus on it that somebody said that you could get from anywhere in the internet that might have occurred or originated from some group, non-government group in Russia or by Russians." So we have now what they found out, and if you took a look at the detail, there was an interesting analysis done about this story in Forbes magazine. So Forbes said, how can this be? How can you take something that's so widely spread, and then it populates itself all over the world as if it were true? And so Forbes magazine went down the line and said, here's how you write a magazine or a newspaper article, and here's how it happened, where one mistake was piled on another mistake. Well, the person that wrote the story didn't properly source it. The headline writer is different than the person who wrote the story. They never talked. The person that wrote the headline was meant for attention grabbing. Other people, other sources grabbed the headline, shortened the story, and spread it all over. And so you have this interesting that the Forbes analysis said as much as 60% of the links shared on social media are shared based on the title alone. So if you write a snappy title, people are going to spread it. But it said the share doesn't actually read the article itself, simply passes along. And thus the title then becomes the story. And because, for example, the Washington Post gave the incorrect title, then that story spread virally, and it became as if there was an echo chamber that the Russians had hacked into the U.S. power grid, when not only did it not happen, it could have easily been verified. And so you look through, it's really a fascinating, it's sort of like doing an autopsy on a news article. What went wrong here? So we have these lack of editorial notes aren't consistent from one editor to the next. They couldn't all see each other's work. And the news, the headline writer was, you know, and they have like four or five or six or seven different people in each article, and they weren't all holding hands. And so this is one of those things that grew out of that environment. And then I thought it quite interesting that we read an article published in Russia Today. What did Russia have to say about this one? Because after all, they were in the middle of it. And there's an Irish woman writing for Russia Today. And she said, she starts out her article, "It's well established in 2016 that most things that go wrong in the world are Russia's fault. And last year, the Washington Post decided to really close out the year with a bang." And she goes on to explain their perspective of how this was easily verified that it did not occur. And so you find this, and I just pick these, the popular ones are the ones that we've known, and then this one is a recent one that we may have heard about. But these aren't the only experiences that we've had with regard to news, as it were. There are other instances throughout history. In fact, many, many instances throughout history. And I'd like to turn to 1 Kings 21 and to take a look at an example that's quoted from time to time in 1 Kings 21. And this is the story, and we've referred to it before, about Ahab and Jezebel, and Ahab wants the vineyard, the field next to him that's owned by Naboth, the Jezreelite. He's really envious of that land. He wants to get the land. And he's whining and moaning about it to his wife, Queen Jezebel. In verse 20, in 1 Kings 21, verse 7, "And Jezebel, his wife, said to him," meaning Ahab, you now exercise authority over Israel. Arise, eat food, let your heart be cheerful, and I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." In verse 8, she wrote, 1 Kings 21, 8, she wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent the letters to the elders and nobles who were dwelling in the city with Naboth. Verse 9, she wrote in the letters saying, "Proclaim a fast, and seat Naboth with high honor among the people." Verse 12, they proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth with high honor. Verse 13, and two men, scoundrels, I don't think we have to go any further definition of what a scoundrel is here. Two men, scoundrels, came in and sat before him, Naboth, and the scoundrels witnessed against him, against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, "Naboth has blasphemed God and the king." And they took him, meaning Naboth, outside the city and stoned him with stones so that he died. You've heard of beware, what is it? The higher they rise, the harder they fall. Well, here they raised up Naboth by these great letters of praise and words of praise. And then they had the false witnesses come in and give lying testimony. It says, aha, one lied and the other swore to it, essentially. And that said he was a blasphemer, outrageous blasphemer. And Naboth died. And then, of course, as the story goes in, and Jezebel tells Ahab, "Well, there, go now take your field. It's yours now. Just go take it. Nobody will fight you for it." Interestingly enough, later on, the son of Ahab and Jezebel, King Joram, in 2 Kings 9:11, who was the second son of Ahab and Jezebel to become king, was then killed by a future king, Jehu. And Jehu ordered his body to be cast in the field of the deceased, Naboth the Jezreelite. Kind of came full circle there, where the line of Ahab ended. The big lie ended there in the same field that he had taken from them. But fake news isn't just in one place. We had fake news at the time of Christ's crucifixion. If we read in Luke 24 and verse 9, and we have this period of time when Christ was crucified, And then after the crucifixion, he was buried 3 days and three nights. And we look in Luke 24, and you had three women, well, and others. In fact, Luke 24:9, they were returned from the tomb and told all these things to the 11, meaning the disciples, and to all the rest. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and other women with them who told these things to the apostles. Verse 11, and their words seemed to them like idle tales. They didn't believe them. This is fake news. It can't be so. I mean, we've all were there. We saw this. We know what happened. It couldn't be so. And they took it as fake news. Of course, that was immediately proved that, in fact, they were telling the truth. Well, this fake news, these stories that we hear in many cases, people are all too willing to hear because it satisfies them. It helps them to feel better about what they already know. We look at Proverbs 18:8. In Proverbs 18:8, and we'll bounce into Proverbs from time to time here. This Proverbs 18:8, the words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body. You know, I particularly like those chocolate-covered Queen Anne cherries. You probably know the kind, you know. Not very expensive. But I have to limit myself because they taste so good. They're very nice. No, taste thing. They just, you know, the little gooey stuff on the inside. Some people don't like them because of the texture, but I really like those things. And, you know, I look forward to that. And I can reward myself every once in a while. I have to be careful. I can't eat the whole box at one sitting, you know. Just No. One a day, maybe, if so, and then try to stretch it out. But they're real tasty. They're delicious. And we all have little things like that that we enjoy. And so we have, and the proverb teller here is, that's what a talebearer is like. There's something that's really delicious. Whoa, did you hear? Whoa, what about that? Now, it's interesting, the Jewish tradition, Proverbs 8:18, they take a little different look at this verse. And they say they are like, instead of tasty trifles, they say like wounds that go down into the inmost body. So you can take it that the receiver finds them very tasty, or you can read it that the recipient, or the one that the bad news was about, or the talebearer was about, was a bad wound, okay, that really hurts. You ever feel really weak when something really bad happens? Your chest hurts, your arms hurt, you're feeling weak. I mean, just the whole, you're everything weak. You know, some horrible thing has happened or something has affected you. And that's what I can read from this, when this verse, if you follow it in that way. It wounds. You're deeply hurt by something, particularly when it's not true. The words of a talebearer. Well, it's bad when it's true, too. Nobody wants those told about oneself either. You'd just rather let it be. In fact, that takes us to the next verse in Proverbs 11:12. Because what do we do if we hear a juicy tidbit? Well, we can ask ourselves, well, is it harmful? In Proverbs 11:12, he is devoid of wisdom, despises his neighbor, but a man of understanding does what? Holds his peace. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter. So your neighbor or someone you know does something that's inappropriate or says something inappropriate. Do you get on the megaphone and spread it all over town, write letters to the editor, explain what a rat they are, and so forth? Because what is it going to be harmful or helpful for that person? And so it says a person devoid of women then despises his neighbor, doesn't really look out for the fellow, isn't trying to build up or be helpful, but a talebearer then reveals the secrets. Well, this revealing of secrets, we can move on to Proverbs 20, verse 19. And what should we do when we know of somebody who's a revealer of secrets? In Proverbs 20:19, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. I can almost see it now. Hey, did you hear this about so-and-so? Did you hear thus and such about thus and such or who? And so forth. I've got some real juicy ones here for you. You know, And that makes you feel good, like you're on the inner circle of really got the good news now, or the latest news. But even if it's true, it's probably not a good thing to spread around when we ask ourselves, is it helpful or harmful? Because we have to ask, then, is what we're going to reveal, does it have good results? In Matthew 12, starting in verse 35, a good man out of the treasure of his heart brings forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say to you that for every idle word that men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Well, that's telling us we should really be careful in what we do, but also we should be careful about what other people are saying and doing, because they are held to that same standard. So if there is something what we call idle talk, where does that lead us? In 1 Timothy 1, verse 3. And here we have Paul writing to his helper, Timothy. In 1 Timothy 1:3, as I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which cause disputes rather than godly edification, which is in faith. Now the purpose of the commandment is love from the pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith, from which some, having strayed, what did they stray from? Well, the pure heart, good conscience, sincere faith, with some having strayed, have turned aside to idle talk. And then it's interesting, in verse 7, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things which they affirm. So even though they may be saying some of the right things, they don't even understand what they themselves are saying, because their heart isn't right. And so we have to be careful for idle talk to make sure it doesn't turn our heart. Well, what's our part then in tale-bearing? We go back to Proverbs 26 and verse 20. And I thought of this from time to time, whether it's on the job or in the community. In Proverbs 26, verse 20. And this metaphorical example is really, really quite good. Where there is no wood, the fire goes out. And when there is no tale-bearer, strife ceases. Where there's no wood, the fire goes out. Where there's no tale-bearer, strife ceases. And then it goes on deeper into the explanation. Verse 21, as charcoal is to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. So we want to kindle strife. We just cause trouble. We just start being a talebearer. And we don't, it doesn't matter really whether it's true or not, if it's not helpful or if it's harmful for someone, we can bear the tale. Now, the implication with talebearer is that they're saying something that's false. But you can also read that it's something that's simply harmful. We have distinct demands or commands in the Bible about what we should do regarding this. In Leviticus 19, verse 16. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. There's a distinct relationship here. If you start telling tales about your neighbor, you are taking a stand against the life of your neighbor. In other words, you're doing him harm in that manner. So one way to do that is to be careful about the environment that we're in that could lead to talebearing. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 11, here again we have the Apostle Paul writing to Timothy, and he's talking about the assistance of how to provide for younger and older widows. And he says, and it's the responsibility of the people within the church to look after the widows who are 60 and older. Verse 11, but refuse the younger widows, for when they've begun to grow wanton against Christ, desire to marry. In other words, they have other interests. having condemnation because they've cast off their first faith, and besides, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not. There's a saying that nature abhors a vacuum. You can't just really have a vacuum, something will rush in to fill it. So if they're not busy doing something that they ought to do, then sin will fill that in. And this is what he's pointing out here, is that they should be busy doing something productive to the best of their ability. Those two terms about here about being gossips and busybodies, those are really Siamese twins. They're stuck together. If we read on, and Paul wrote to in the letter to 2 Thessalonians, in 2 Thessalonians 3:11, "For we hear that there are some who walk among you in disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies." In other words, always in other people's business, but aren't productively engaged themselves. Well, it sounds really rather annoying, but not really life-threatening. So now let's turn to 1 Peter 4 in verse 14, and we'll see how it's not just annoying, because we're going to see here that tale-bearing is equated with murder, theft, evil-doing, or being a busybody. In 1 Peter 4:14, "If you're reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he's blasphemed, but on your part he's glorified." Verse 15, "But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters." So he's putting this all together. If you're going to suffer because of the right reasons, because you're following Christ, not these other reasons. "Yet if someone suffers as a Christian," verse 16, "let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this manner." So it's okay to suffer as a Christian. That's not a sin. But those other reasons, well, you brought that on yourself. Of course, we have to be careful not to dig up those tasty tidbits to spread about other people. I have to go out of my way to avoid buying the little chocolate-covered Queen Anne cherries, lest I buy them. And so I have to make sure that I avoid those. And so I try to not buy them. That way I won't be so tempted. But if somebody gives them to me, well, you know, I guess I try to restrain myself. But should we go looking about for those tasty tidbits? Back to Proverbs 16, verse 21 or 27. "An ungodly man," Proverbs 16:27, "an ungodly man digs up evil, and it's on his lips like a burning fire. A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends." Maybe you've seen that, where somebody said something, and friends were then divided. People that had a close relationship, and somebody said something, and that caused the relationship to end that relationship. The best of friends, not just casual friends, the best ones, where they were close. And yet the tale that was told separated them. The Apostle Paul, writing again in 1 Timothy 6:20, wrote about false news that's passed off as the truth in 1 Timothy 6:20. "O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust, avoiding the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. By professing it, some have strayed concerning the faith." So he's saying that there are profane and idle babblings that are falsely called knowledge. People believe them. They're told these things, and then they just don't do any back-checking. They just don't do it. So what should we do? Paul writes then in 2 Timothy. And we often read in 2 Timothy 2:15 about being diligent students of the Bible. But let's read on when we read 2 Timothy 2:15. "Be diligent to present yourselves approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." And then verse 16, "But shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness, and their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth." And he went on to say, well, what they did is said the resurrection is already past, and they overthrow the faith of some. So he gave an example of those who got caught up in the profane or idle babblings and increased ungodliness, and the message spread like cancer. In other words, it affected them. And as we are all part of one body, if the cancer spreads within the body, it can affect the whole body. So that can hurt the entire fellowship. Paul writes then to in Titus 1, verse 10. For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, meaning of the faith, those who should be believers, and yet they're idle talkers and deceivers. And what does he say in Titus 1, verse 11? Whose mouths must be stopped. Well, the best way to stop saying something wrong is to say something right, to do that. So that was the encouragement. Because those who don't stop subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. They see something in it for them, even if it's bringing down someone else. And this is followed up in Proverbs 11:9. The hypocrite through his mouth destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge the righteous will be delivered. Let's look for that right and true knowledge, and not just stumble in and accidentally, because we didn't bother to check, to hurt our neighbor. We've already read about the devoid of wisdom, despising the neighbor, and the wisdom of holding your peace. But I do remember one, and probably the one that comes to mind the most, and you may have heard it from time to time, in Proverbs 18:17. The first one to plead his cause seems right. In other words, the newspaper headline, the big splash, this happened today, or here's what's going on, breaking news, it's going on right now. That one seems right. What's the last half of that verse? Until his neighbor comes and examines him. So that's our job. Are we the neighbor that will examine that to see if it's true? Just because somebody says, and because they're good people, does that necessarily mean that everything that they say comes forth that's thoroughly vetted or thoroughly the truth? And so in Proverbs 18, the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. In the court system in America, we have what's called the adversarial system, where if one person makes an accusation, the other person could come before the court and say, wait a minute, this is the story here, and we challenge. And then the first party says, but this, I have this, you know, we have this piece of evidence. The other one says, but I have this. We can show that does not rise to the level, or it's misunderstood. And they can go back and forth so they can examine each other. It's called an adversarial system. But it's really effective in the sense that there's an opportunity for someone to search out the accusation against one. Okay, we're in Proverbs. Let's go to Proverbs 28, verse 11. Proverbs 28, verse 11. The rich man is wise in his own eyes. Doesn't mean he's wise. It means he's wise in his own eyes. Although he has to have some wisdom there, he probably wouldn't be a rich man. What's the last half of that verse? But the poor who has understanding searches him out. That's just like what we read earlier about the neighbor searching out to see if these things be so. Just because of their status in society doesn't mean that there is that it's automatically true just because they have a title of some sort or another. And of course, in Proverbs 25, verse 9, debate your case with your neighbor and do not disclose the secret to another. You know, we have people who apply to work at certain companies. They have to sign what's called a non-disclosure agreement. This means that whatever you learn while you're talking to us, you may not disclose. What if you're going to hire somebody from a competitor? Or two companies are looking to do a potential merger. They sign disclosure agreements where they cannot release the information that they learned about one to another. One of my former employers in Los Angeles, we had a 70,000 square foot facility, and one the owner of the building was writing a long-term lease for the company that, for my boss, the company, the people that owned the company. The lease was 60 pages long. It included non-disclosure agreements about either side. In other words, very detailed. If they would simply follow Proverbs 25:9, you just don't disclose the secrets when you discuss these things with your neighbor. You wouldn't have that issue. But neither one of them trusted the other one any farther than they could throw him. And so they had this 60-page agreement. And then, of course, we have, and what you're all thinking, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it, is in Exodus 20, verse 16, how simple it would be if we followed what God said directly from God regarding truthfulness in Exodus 20, verse 16. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Well, of course, who's your neighbor? It's anybody who might possibly hear your witness. It's really the answer to that. We're right there in Exodus 20, 16. Let's flip to Exodus 23, verse 1. And this really speaks to the news issue, whether it's your mouth or in writing or in some other way. You shall not circulate a false report. Don't put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You may not even realize it. You may be unwittingly going along and spreading something that may not be true. And of course, that's the Ten Commandments are reiterated or stated over again in other parts of the Bible. There's in Deuteronomy 19, there's an explanation as to what happens if there's a false witness. And if this were carried out, I suspect there would be a whole lot fewer false witnesses in Deuteronomy 19. If a false witness rises against any man, Deuteronomy 19:16, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, verse 18, the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother, so shall you put away the evil from among you. So if there was a penalty that was due to the person accused, but because of the false of witness, that penalty, when it finds out there's a false witness, the penalty was then to be suffered by the false accuser. And if that were carried out, you'd have to be pretty sure about your witness before you were offering it, particularly in an extraordinarily severe instance. We're close there in Proverbs 25:18, and I know this feeling. I probably should have mentioned it earlier. A man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a club, a sword, and a sharp arrow. I've never been hit with a club. I've never been sliced with a sword. And I've never been pierced with a sharp arrow. I don't have to in order to imagine what it can feel like, because none of those sound good. And so if it's a false witness, and it's false, and it's found out, what would it feel like coming back if you were the one that carried the club, the sword, or the arrow? because it's in the heart of mankind. In Matthew 25:19, we know it's in the heart. We've seen it. We've seen it over and over again. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, and then false witness and blasphemies. And so you have this striking commandment of how much better life would be if we didn't have that issue. Christ suffered the issue when they were looking to condemn Christ and looking to condemn him, and they were trying to find witnesses against him. Matthew 26:60, but they found none. Even though their false witnesses came forward, they found, in other words, there were people that they couldn't make it stick. At last, two witnesses came forward in Matthew 26:60. That's repeated in Mark that says, many bore false witness against them, but their testimonies didn't agree. Oops, they didn't plan it out well enough. And I've seen that in more than one court case where the witnesses contradicted each other. Well, that they lose credibility then. And then there's the terrible case that hopefully none of us will ever be in someday in Acts 6:13. And it's the false witnesses that stood up against Stephen and were accusing him. He was the deacon giving a sermon. They set up false witnesses who said in Acts 6:13, "This man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law." So they created a false mindset that Stephen was somehow a blasphemer, speaking the truth, and yet they were saying that what he said was fake news. And he died, just like Naboth the Jezreelite was suffered death because of somebody else's fake news. And then last verse in 1 Corinthians 15:15. We're talking here in 1 Corinthians 15 about Paul's letter to Corinth. "Yes, and we are found false witnesses of God, because we've testified of God, and he was raised up Christ, whom he did not raise up, if in fact the dead don't rise." In other words, if Christ didn't really rise, then we're all false witnesses. So that leaves the question then, of course, we know it's true that Christ did raise up, and he was saying that to make his point. But then we have to ask ourselves, is our life a true witness or a false witness? Because it is our job to have it be our lives be a true witness of the life and the death and the purpose of Jesus Christ. So as we live in this post-truth world, we must be extraordinarily careful to guard our ears and our eyes from the flood of information that surrounds us each day. We can attempt to block out everything and believe no one, or we can learn to become discerning. We can develop our mind and our senses to search out the truth based on reality. The Bible is a good place to learn how to sift out the truth in a world where the truth is not easy to find. We must live to learn, live, not just live, but thrive in a post-truth world.